Hello and welcome to this episode of the ESG Fitness Podcast. This morning I have been doing some one-to-one client check-ins, and one question I had for the podcast was how to manage emotional tsunamis and stay on track. So, you know, just quite a small question for the podcast. I probably have this up there with like, what is the meaning of life? Quite a tough one to answer, but I thought I would give it my best shot, and hopefully this will be helpful to some people. So I think in this situation, perspective is your best friend, and it's going to be quite individual how you find that. So I wrote a list of a few things that help me find perspective. The first one's going to be really obvious and quite unhelpful really, but going for a walk. I find that being in nature or just outside of your normal environment, basically in a different environment, really helps with perspective. And I think if you can get away from your normal home as well, like not just a walk around the block, like can you go a little bit further? So for example, where I live, just over the river that I live next to, or the estuary, if you will, where the river meets the sea, just over the other side is a really nice place called Newport, which coincidentally is where my parents live, which is lovely. And it's about probably a 2 or 3 minute drive, but it feels so far away from Dundee, which is where I live. I mean, not that far away, obviously, but it gives you that almost like barrier that it just feels like you're stepping out of work mode or stress mode or whatever it is, family mode, whatever it is that's stressing you out. So that's my first tip. And my second tip is that I will think about how I'll feel in a week, in a year, on my deathbed, like depending on the size of the problem or stress that I'm having or decision that I'm trying to make. So if it's a minor thing, I might consider if I'll care about this next week. And if it's a slightly bigger problem, I might think, will I care about this in a month? And again, if it's a little bit bigger, maybe I'd be like, this time next year, will this decision still be impacting me? Like how much effort and time and like mental energy and emotion should I be putting into this? Or maybe it is even bigger and you need to think about a year or 5 years. And then for the really big ones, I consider like, will I care on my deathbed? And I know it's quite morbid, but it really works for me. And I do sometimes think of those letters that people write to their younger selves, like when they're dying, and they're like, they're always essentially saying, stop worrying about irrelevant shit because it's ruining your happiness. Or stop ruining the journey by worrying about the destination and complaining about everything along the way. Usually it's things like that. Usually it's like, worry less. Be more carefree, spend more money, be more adventurous. So again, that's another way of finding perspective. And my third tip is reading about space and or evolution, mainly just to remind myself how irrelevant I am. I'm not sure if anyone else does this, but I think it's one of the reasons more broadly as well that I enjoy science, because it feels like it's bigger than me, and thus it makes my problems or whatever I'm stressing about in perspective completely inconsequential. And when you start thinking about space and time and how your life is just this tiny little blip in the grand scheme of things, it becomes far easier to let go of the fact that someone scratched your car or your boiler leaked, or you've not lost weight this week. And my fourth tip is doing something kind for someone else or charitable. If I'm feeling pretty shit about myself, I will try and do something nice for someone else, and it usually makes me feel better as well. For me, something that is really important is impact, and I think it strongly leads into how much purpose I feel and thus my self-worth as well. So if I feel like I'm having a positive impact, then I tend to feel better about myself generally. And then my fifth point would be to write it down to try and make sense of it. Writing something down and working through your feelings is so unbelievably useful. Sometimes purely to realize that they don't make that much sense and you're often feeding yourself lies or it's easier to highlight your own self-limiting beliefs when you're having to write them down or explain them to someone. So either talking about it or writing about it. And something I find useful when I reach the point of like, this is the worst thing that could happen, I then don't stop there, because that's what most of us do. They're like, oh my God, I would lose my house. And then they stop there. And it's like, right, well, yeah, I mean, it wouldn't be great if you lost your house. But then what would happen? Like, then you need to work through that catastrophe to realize life would go on. So, for example, if I'm worried about a business failing, I might ask myself, like, what is the worst that can happen? Right, let's go with this example. We'll go with AFM. Let's hope I don't jinx it here. But let's say I launched AFM and I had no signups. That's probably the worst case scenario. And really all that would mean is that I've wasted a little bit of time, maybe a little bit of money, and maybe my ego is a bit bruised because I've said publicly that I'm going to do this thing and then I've not done it, and maybe people will kind of put two and two together and realize that it wasn't very popular. Like, that's basically the worst case scenario. So when you actually talk it through and write that out, and I'm sure there's, you know, I speak to a lot of personal trainers who are like, oh, I really want to do this, but I'm worried no one will sign up. Okay, what if no one signs up? Like, you make the product better, or you realize it isn't actually what people wanted. I mean, that would be the first thing. And it's also why I don't think I'll get no signups for AFM, because it's something that people have asked me for. Like, do a little bit of market research first, and then you're probably going to bypass this problem. But let's say that did happen, and that's your worst case scenario, that you launch a program and nobody signs up. Like, it's really not that bad, is it? And when you write it out and write what the consequences of that would be, like, oh, okay, so the negatives here is I've wasted a bit of time, I've maybe bruised my ego a little bit, and maybe I spent a little bit of money trying to set a few websites up, or I don't know, had some tech on the go or something that like I've invested a little bit of money into. Not really the end of the world. And then the positives of this is that I'm sure you will have learned something from it. And the second point is, no one really cares about your failures. And equally, I mean, I don't care about the opinions of people who enjoy seeing me fail. It's so irrelevant to me what they think, because I don't want them in my life anyway. Like, I want to see other people do well, and I also want to surround myself with people who want to see me do well. And you will attract what you put out. And I've actually noticed that more and more recently. I feel like there are so many people around me who give me really lovely feedback and want to see me do well. And that's an amazing feeling, and it's absolutely reciprocated. Another common example of this is, maybe you want to do Commit to Six or any fat loss program, or maybe not fat loss. Hey, let's not always make it about fat loss, but any program, but you're worried that you're going to quote unquote fail or not get the results that you want. My first point would be, you won't on Commit to Six because you have the best support. But my second point, which is probably more important here, even if you came to Commit to Six, let's say you did want to lose some fat, and for some reason you didn't lose any, you will still learn a hell of a lot. And I will never promise anyone results. And actually this week, for some reason, I feel like I've had quite a lot of messages about Commit to Six, which are almost, actually, maybe this is more my perception of them now I'm thinking about it. I felt like they were asking me to tell them they would get results. Really what they're looking for is a little bit of reassurance. Like, I'm a little bit worried about starting because, you know, I've done these programs before and it didn't work for me. And like, I'm just worried that I put in this time and effort and money and I don't get the results that I want. And I felt like, oh, are you trying to get me to say, I promise you, you will lose fat, because I'm never going to say that. Those words will never come out my mouth. But what I can promise you is a hell of a lot of support. And anyone who does promise you results is a snake. a snaky snake and you should not trust them. So if you are speaking to someone like, oh yeah, I can promise you that within this amount of time you'll lose this much weight, or I promise that you'll fit into this dress by this time, they are lying to you. And so immediately you shouldn't do their program just based on that fact alone. But what I can promise you is that if you put in the effort, you will be rewarded. And if you engage, you will learn. And if you ask for support, you will get so much support from us. And because this has just naturally turned into apparently a sales pitch for Commit to Six, you only have a week to sign up for the April intake, which starts on the 6th of April. So I would get that done ASAP. And you can do that at esgfitness.co.uk/commit-to-6. If you do want to talk to me about it before, obviously I'm not going to promise you results, but I'm more than happy to offer some reassurance if you are feeling unsure. So do just shoot me a message. Anyway, back to my point. Writing things down is really useful, but don't stop at the worst part. Ask yourself, and then what? Like, what would happen in this worst case scenario? What am I really so worried about? And often when you explore that, you realize there isn't that much to be worried about. Okay, let's get into the podcast topic, because that was meant to be a really short introduction, but then I got a little bit carried away. So this episode is on confidence. And I want to start with imposter syndrome, because I've been talking to a lot of coaches recently, both on EIQ and those interested in signing up to AFM. And this has come up with almost everyone. So the definition of imposter syndrome is a psychological pattern in which an individual doubts their skills, talents, or accomplishments and has a persistent internalized fear of being exposed as a fraud. Now, I think to some extent we all experience these feelings, and it would be a little bit odd if we didn't. And if you've never felt this way, then you're probably a little bit delusional as to how much you know. So you probably don't yet realize how little you know and how much there is to know and how much you still have to learn. And I think that's a great thing to know, as long as you can come at it with a growth mindset of, this is so exciting, there's still so much left to know, not become overwhelmed by it. Like, oh my God, I don't think I should even be working with people because I don't know everything, which is always going to be impossible. So there's a line, I guess, there. Probably like that inverted U curve that I always talk about and absolutely love. Like, there's an optimal level of, well, the whole curve is around this optimal level of arousal. But that always sounds a bit sexual, I guess. Or maybe that is just where my head goes. Anyway, you want to be excited by the opportunity to learn and grow, not overwhelmed by it. So the big problem arises when we let this feeling of imposter syndrome stop us doing important things. Things? Damn it. I was doing really well at the pronunciations. Things. Oh, so I got some feedback on the podcast this week, and it was that I say less when I should be saying fewer. So for example, I'd be like, oh, you should take less steps, but actually you should be saying you should take fewer steps. And anyway, I told my dad this, and he was like, I've been telling Kate this for weeks. He was like, I've seen it. This is happening all the time on the radio, blah, blah, blah. And he was like, Kate is my mum. He was like, she didn't really seem to care. She didn't seem to be noticed by it. And I was like, well, I'm actually quite surprised by how much it's quite clearly impacted my dad. So I'm going to have to work on that. I'll be pulling myself up on that. But I think he explained it as, when it's units of things like steps, it's fewer. But when it's, oh, now I can't think of it. When it's like I don't know. Okay, I think it's when it's a thing. So like, I'm less happy because I'm taking fewer steps. There you go. Anyway, the problem with imposter syndrome is if it's stopping you doing things that you want to do or that are going to help you grow, or if it's just generally giving you anxiety day to day. So if you're struggling with this, the first thing I would remind yourself of is that you don't need to know everything. For example, I'm about to talk about a lot of things that I am certainly not an expert on in this podcast, namely some psychology research I've been reading. Now, I don't claim to be an expert. I just found this interesting and useful to me, and so I wanted to share it. And by the way, that goes for essentially everything I talk about on the podcast. I am certainly not an expert in most of the things that I discuss. And as soon as you take that pressure off yourself, then it becomes far easier just to accept where you are and accept that you still have a lot to learn. And that's an exciting thing, as opposed to putting all this pressure on yourself to know everything and have the answers to everything. So in my opinion, the best cure for imposter syndrome is to be yourself. If you know who you are and what you stand for, and you act in a way that aligns with that, then no one can call you out or expose you as a fraud, because you have absolutely nothing to hide. If you accept your flaws and you embrace continuous learning, and you're not afraid to say, I was wrong about that, or let me go and do some research on that and come back to you because I don't actually know the answer, or I don't know enough about this topic at the moment to have an opinion on it, but maybe someone else does. And I really like the word enough here. Like, I don't know enough about this topic, because it insinuates that you have a knowledge of something, but there is more to know and there is more to learn, and that you're open to learning. I think what is hard is it's very easy to say, you need to know who you are and what you stand for. And like, as if we should all just know that. And I think that actually that takes a long time to refine and to learn, and it's continuously changing. And I don't think it's something that we, especially if you're not particularly reflective at the moment, then it's not something that you might actually really know about yourself or question yourself about. It's a pretty deep question, and I think it can take years to really work out. And I would say, after 10 years in the industry, I'm probably figuring that out about now, because it changes and it grows and it adapts. And as I'm saying that, I'm like, that is such a ridiculous thing to say, because it is literally the history illusion, which is, no, wait, what is it? It's called the end of history illusion, which I find really interesting. But essentially, this is what Wikipedia calls it, actually. Here we go. The end of history illusion is a psychological illusion in which individuals of all ages believe that they have experienced significant personal growth and changes in taste up to the present moment, but will not substantially grow or mature in the future. Despite recognizing that their perceptions have evolved, individuals predict that their perceptions will remain roughly the same in the future. So essentially, that you've changed loads up until now, but now this is you set. Like, now you're a full person. You've done so much self-work that now you don't need to do anymore. And I definitely have that thought, which is really funny. I'm like, oh yeah, I mean, last couple of years, I didn't really know who I was, and now I just feel like I really know myself really well. But I'm sure that that's not true, and in a couple of years I'll be like, oh God. So yeah, I'm open to the fact that I am certainly falling for that. I actually think we all fall for that. We're like, yeah, when I wasn't as educated, when I didn't know myself as well, before I had a therapist, I used to think like this or that, or I had those views. But now that I'm fully self-aware and enlightened, which, like, it's just the most ridiculous concept, isn't it? But I do think it's very easy to think like that. Generally, we always underestimate future change. Okay, so moving on to the topic, which is confidence. Something that I thought would be an interesting way to look at this is the difference between confidence and self-efficacy. And there's quite a lot of debate in the literature around this. And as I said, I'm not an expert, but generally this is what I have, deducted. This is my current hypothesis or conclusion from what I currently know. Self-efficacy refers to beliefs about one's ability to perform a specific task. So, for example, I'm good at driving, I'm good at public speaking, that's a lie, I'm good at studying, whatever it is. And then self-confidence refers to the belief in one's personal worth and likelihood of succeeding. So self-confidence is a combination of self-esteem and general self-efficacy. We'll come on to self-esteem. In fact, I'm going to do a whole nother podcast on self-esteem because I have a lot to say about it. But essentially what we're saying here is confidence is quite broad. So you could be a confident person in many areas of life, whereas self-efficacy is specific. So you might be really confident in your ability to, complete a very specific task. Maybe you're very confident at work, but you're not very confident out with work. Or you're very confident in certain structured environments, but generally you lack confidence. And I think when people do a lot of further education to increase their confidence, really what they're looking to increase is their self-efficacy in a given task. So that maybe that given task is coaching their athletes or their clients on nutrition. So they do more nutrition qualifications. So they're building self-efficacy in that as opposed to general confidence. Or an example for me, I am very at home and confident in the gym environment, but I feel completely out of place and awkward in a nightclub. And I am very confident in my ability to drive a car, but I'm not confident in my ability to fly a plane. So self-efficacy specifies the task. People who generally develop high levels of self-efficacy for tasks tend to have these attributes. So they view challenging problems as tasks that can be mastered or challenges. They tend to form a stronger sense of commitment to their interests or their activities or the task that they're doing, and they recover quickly from setbacks or disappointments. Essentially, it's like having a growth mindset. And on the flip side, those who have a weak sense of self-efficacy tend to avoid challenging tasks. They believe that difficult tasks and situations are beyond their capabilities, so they won't even try. They focus on personal failings and negative outcomes as opposed to learning from their mistakes, and they quickly lose confidence in their personal abilities. So essentially, they're easily put off by setbacks. And you can see how the attributes of the latter would hold you back in all areas of life. Now, obviously, I'm thinking about fat loss, fitness, business, because that's what I do. And when I was reading about this, I was mostly reading, what was his name? Bandura's work? Bandura, I think that's right. And he specifies four components of self-efficacy. And these are, number one, mastery experiences, whereby successes build robust sense of self-efficacy and failure diminishes it. So for example, if you continue to keep absolutely nailing double unders, your confidence in your ability, i.e. your self-efficacy, will increase. If you keep failing at them, it will diminish. So if you keep getting rejected for jobs after interviews, you will likely start to perceive yourself to be a poor interviewer. And this is a harder situation than the double unders because your success is not completely in your control. Like, you can't control who else applies for the job or what exactly it is that the interviewer is looking for. And actually, it might have nothing to do with your interview skills. The second component is social modelling. This is seeing others similar to one's self achieve their goals through their effort and perseverance, and that providing sources of aspiration and motivation, which raises the observer's belief in their own abilities. Which is another reason to surround yourself with others that are doing what you want to do, but maybe slightly better. Things can often seem impossible until you see other people achieve them, and it especially helps if they are your peers, and thus they are relatable to you. It's the whole, oh, if Emma can do it, why can't I do it? That really works. It's probably one of the fundamental reasons. In fact, it is one of the fundamental reasons that we get such good results doing group coaching. Because you're seeing someone who's just like you getting the results that you want, implementing the things that their coach has told them. And that is so inspiring. And it sounds way better, or just looks way better as well, when it comes from someone who is, I don't know, maybe has much more similarities to you on paper, at least, than I do. Like maybe you're both busy single mums and you're both about 40 years old, like, and you're ticking similar boxes. That person is far more relatable to you than I am. So sometimes the motivation needs to come from your peers. Number three is social persuasion. People could be persuaded to believe that they have the skills and capabilities to succeed. Getting verbal encouragement from others helps people overcome self-doubt and instead focus on giving their best effort to the task at hand. What does that sound like? That sounds a little bit like coaching. Yes, yes, I think it does. So there we go. And number four, physical and emotional states. So a positive mood enhances self-efficacy and a negative mood diminishes it. And further, I would say it's how you choose to respond to situations, so positively or negatively. Are you trying to look at things as an opportunity for growth, or are you looking for justifications for your excuses? Do you want solutions, or do you want a reason why you can't achieve something? Are you just looking for the justification? So a quote here from one of the researchers is, "It is not the sheer intensity of emotion and physical reactions that is important, but rather how they are perceived and interpreted." And I've spoken about this in relation to how we view stress previously. If you want to listen to that, I'm pretty sure it was called Rethinking How We View Stress, or something along those lines. And instead of seeing it as a negative, can we see it for what it is? So you have lots of things that you care about, which means you have a very full and rich life. And if you flip stress on its head and you take away everything that you're stressed about, you wouldn't have anything in your life. You wouldn't have any purpose. You wouldn't have all the things that you love and care about. So the reason that you're stressed is because you have all these things, is because you have a rich, full life. Like, you're stressed about getting your kids to school on time because you have happy, healthy kids that are able to go to school. All of the things that are stressing you are actually things that you should be grateful for. And not even actually, I hate the "you should be grateful," but it's things that you are grateful for. You're just not thinking about it from that perspective. So I found that by looking at these four components, you can really get your head around what self-efficacy is, i.e. a perceived belief which affects our actions, and in turn, our actions affect our self-efficacy. It also quite nicely allows us to create a plan to increase self-efficacy. So if we know that these four components are what make up self-efficacy, can we use them in a way that's going to help us increase our own? So number one, you've got mastery experiences. So to do this, you have to be willing to try things. And then you need to internalize your wins and learn from your failures. The second one was social modeling. Surround yourself with the right people. The third one, social persuasion. get a coach or a mentor. The fourth one, learn to manage your emotions. I mean, that's not ever going to be a quick fix and easy, but now you've got those four components, you can start to action them. I truly believe that mastering this and thus believing in yourself will open so many doors for you, and it doesn't happen by accident. Don't just wait to suddenly magically feel confident in your ability. Hopefully you will have come to this conclusion yourself, but the problem with waiting to be confident is that you need to take action to build confidence. So if we're looking at the first principle, how are you meant to have experiences of success if you're not willing to try anything? A rule that I set myself a couple of years ago that I live by is never say no to something because of lack of confidence. If you're turning down an opportunity, you need to have a legitimate excuse. By the way, this is like a note to myself. This is what I tell myself. Like, if you're turning this opportunity down, is this a legitimate excuse or are you just scared? Because if you're scared, that's actually a reason to do it. Like, you need to lean into lack of confidence because it's the only way that you will build confidence. Okay, this is going to be a two-parter, because I want to talk about self-esteem as well, but I think I'll do that in a whole other podcast because I think that would go on too long. I also want to say a massive thank you to everyone who shares the podcast. I know I always say this, but it genuinely means so much to me, and I've had such lovely messages this week. And I do gauge the podcast and the topics which people like essentially on how many shares they get and how much people are talking about them. So if you enjoyed this podcast and you like this kind of chat, then give me some feedback, let me know, tag me in your story, leave a review, rate the podcast, all the good stuff. That would be greatly appreciated. And if you are interested in signing up to AFM, then head to appliedfitnessmentors.com or just go to @AFMentors on Instagram. And if you want to sign up to Commit to Six, you've not got long. I'm very excited about this intake. So the next intake starts on the 5th of April, which I've just realized is Easter Monday. So that's great. So you can have your Easter eggs on the weekend and then get started on the Monday, all fully fueled with chocolate. There you go. And thank you so much for listening.